it's Diane. On my mind, the Boy Scouts sexual abuse settlement. Last week, the Boy Scouts of America reached a tentative deal with lawyers representing some 80,000 victims of child sex abuse. The organization agreed to pay $850 million in damages, the largest payout of its kind in this country. But this will not put an end to the issue. Negotiations took place in bankruptcy court, as the Boy Scouts declared Chapter 11 in 2020, a move meant to stop the flow of lawsuits being brought against them. Insurance companies are also concerned about their own liability. Marcy Hamilton is founder and CEO of Child USA, a research and advocacy organization focused on child abuse and neglect. She joined me Friday morning to explain the deal and whether she thinks justice was served. Marcy, I wonder if you would give us some background on this huge lawsuit against the Boy Scouts of America.
So there were thousands of claims across the United States we knew about against the Boy Scouts, because we had heard about the perversion files, you know, a decade ago. But many of these victims were out of statute. They didn't have options. Openings occurred, and the Boy Scouts responded to that movement by filing for federal bankruptcy. So they chose this Chapter 11 pathway, which is, it's configured. It's made for the purpose of protecting the debtor, the Boy Scouts. And in our view at Child USA, it just sacrifices the victims in the process.
Well, tell me about their bankruptcy. I gather the judge has postponed a hearing on this whole issue of bankruptcy until July 29th.
So there is an internal fight between the survivor groups and their attorneys. And so there's one group that's part of the Tort Claimants Committee, which is the ordinary process. There's another group that is a much larger group, actually, of attorneys and survivors, and they are not agreeing 100%, shall we say, on the path forward. There is a deal that's been cut that Boy Scouts would like, apparently, but it really comes out to very small amounts for each of the survivors. So it's interesting and it's challenging, I think, for everybody involved.
How much money are we talking about? How many claimants are we talking about?
Well, as I understand it, we're going to be about 80,000 claimants total. So this is national. It's a huge organization that's been going on for decades and decades, so it's not terribly surprising those numbers are that high. But the number that's been floated by the Boy Scouts right now is $850 million. That sounds like a lot of money, and that is why dioceses and in the past the Hare Krishnas and now the Boy Scouts really like bankruptcy as a way to resolve child abuse claims. Because it aggregates it. It makes it look like they're paying so much. But in fact, you know, on average, victims will be spending about $830,000 over the course of their lifetimes for the harm done to them. This settlement is going to give them $10,000 apiece. Now, what it leaves to the side is now they can go litigate against the insurance companies. And that was kind of the model that Penn State followed. So Penn State settled out with some fair settlements, and then there was a fight between the insurance companies. But Penn State paid these victims, and then there was the fight. This is the victims get de minimis, and then we'll see how long the insurance companies fight the victims.
And how does all this compare to what happened with the Roman Catholic Church and the claimants who came forward against it?
So the reason the Catholic Church cases are different is because they're limited to each diocese or archdiocese. So we've had close to 30 of these Chapter 11 bankruptcies by diocese, but they are limited geographically. The Boy Scouts is national. This is the first time we've seen a group able to bring everybody in the country into the same tent and then force them to settle at the same time.
So what if there had not been a declaration of bankruptcy? What if the courts had not accepted that?
So if we weren't in bankruptcy, these would be individual cases brought against Boy Scouts and against the councils, which are the local groups that actually own the land, which is so much of their value. And so it would be all over the country. And each state would have different laws, which is the way our system works. So it would be a highly complicated situation. Our view is it's time to amend the federal bankruptcy laws and make them more victim sensitive. Right now, it's pretty much a truck drives through the victim's story and then says, take this or else. And there's just got to be a better way.
Have there been time limitations placed on victims applying for this remuneration for what they've suffered?
So I haven't been on the inside of the discussions, but typically what happens with this arena is that we have victims with different qualities of claims because of the different statutes of limitations. So you might have a claim devalued because you are not in statute, and then another claim that's much higher in value because you're in statute. And then, of course, all of that doesn't really relate to the quality of and the level of the trauma you experienced. So this is a bit of a mess. For the survivors, I feel bad for them, having to figure out what to do, what to accept, where to go. A lot of good attorneys in this field. But the federal bankruptcy laws are not really victim-centered.
And what about the insurers? There are a number who are not happy about this at all.
No. So the insurance industry has really been an enemy of child sex abuse victims for decades because they fight justice for the victims in state after state. They've almost single-handedly stopped justice in the state of Pennsylvania. But I think they've got it wrong. I think that they ought to be part of the prevention plan. They ought to be forcing youth-serving organizations into better policy plans so that they have prevention built into the plan. And you shouldn't be able to get insurance if you're a youth-serving organization and you're endangering children. So the problem for the insurance industry is they're too short-sighted. They're looking solely at what they can make today instead of how can they prevent a lot more of this in the future. You know, we wear seatbelts because of them. We can stop child sex abuse to a large degree if we can get the insurance industry to become more victim-centered and less interested in secrecies and cover-up.
So how could that happen? It would seem to me it would take a whole lot of work to get the insurance industry to see its role in a very different way.
So we are actually, I'm thrilled to say, we're about to launch a pilot program in which insurance companies that insure some of the major youth-serving organizations will, in fact, apply what we have outlined as the gold standard for child protection. And if your gym or your school has that standard, you get a discount on insurance. If it is egregiously in violation, you're going to have a problem getting insurance. So we are launching this in the near future, and then we're going to track it, and we're going to prove to the insurance industry they'll save money if they get on the side of prevention rather than having to have all of these lawsuits. So this is you're right, it's a tough battle, but it's worth it. And in the United States, that's how we prevent risk. It's through insurance.
Marcy, how far back do some of these claims against the Boy Scouts of America go?
They do go decades. They go back to the 50s. There are a lot of survivors who hadn't come forward, some that might never have come forward, but for the publicity and all of the ads and everything, the average age to come forward based on the best science is age 52. So for the vast majority of these victims, some of them just told their families, and they had to tell them to be part of the bankruptcy.
Are there particulars and particular cases that stand out because of the abuse experienced?
I can tell you that this group, I mean, you can imagine with 80,000 cases, they are all over the map. There are some that are multiple perpetrators at the same campsite, and there are others that are, you know, it was one time and it happened in the church. So this is, it's complicated, but the one thing we know for sure is that the trauma of sex abuse does not affect each victim the same. It's all based on that individual's current development, support system, parents, lack of parents. And so each of these individuals has a separate story and a separate claim for damages, but bankruptcy doesn't work like that.
Explain to me what each victim has gone through to be part of this case.
So each of the victims has had to find an attorney and has had to fill out a form. And that sounds de minimis, but think about filling out your tax forms on steroids. This is talking about the worst thing that may have ever happened to you in your life. You're required to disclose to make it clear why you should be even involved. You're challenged on, oh, you say it was 1968. We see that that campsite was only open until 1967. Well, you know, I don't remember the difference between 67 and 68. And a traumatized individual, while they often remember colors, weather, light, the way the person smelled, the exact date is tough. And so what it does is it, in a lot of ways, it re-traumatizes them as they have to live through it again to make the claim. So, you know, my view, great, it's worth it if it comes out to a fair settlement. It's sad if it's just going to turn out to be just a lot of dollars, but for each of the victims, not a whole lot of help.
And in many cases, considering the fact that you say the median age is about 52, you have very few of those parents of those boys still alive to tell their side of the story. Did each of those victims allegedly report their abuse to someone?
The vast majority of children don't. Only about a third. Most of these individuals did not. They might have mentioned it to a friend, you know, a safe peer, but telling it to the authorities or telling it to parents, unlikely. But parents can provide corroborating evidence. You know, one of the signs of abuse is you've got a 12-year-old, all of a sudden they start drinking beer, or all of a sudden they start being away from the house and doing odd things. They don't do well in school. All of a sudden they don't want to play football anymore. All of those kinds of changes can be part of the record to corroborate this. But, I mean, what we know for sure is the vast majority of abuse in the Boy Scouts was by Boy Scout leaders. And a lot of it happened in places kids didn't have a chance, in campgrounds with no capacity to find any kind of support. So it's a system that builds child sex abuse rings, and it builds just terrible problems for these kids. And frankly, I continue to be worried about the Boy Scout system and the way they're thinking about child protection.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. If there is this bankruptcy ruling, how do the Boy Scouts continue with this kind of a payout, as minimal as it may seem for each of those victims?
apparently they have plenty to go forward. And the goal of Chapter 11 by law is to preserve the entity. And so you preserve the entity and cut off all of their obligations in the future. And all the people that have been hurt by them are supposed to just wander off. So this is, it's not a trial on the merits. It's not the victim being vindicated in public. It's a victim in a crowd. And basically, this is about preserving the Boy Scouts. And that's what Chapter 11 does. And it has to change. At a minimum, we have to start educating the federal bankruptcy judges on trauma and re-traumatization.
Why do you suppose the judge in this case, in this bankruptcy case, which has been postponed until July 29th, why do you suppose it was postponed?
I think it's because of some lively discussions between all of the attorneys. The two camps are not in the same space, and they don't think they should be following the same approach. So one camp is largely the experienced child sex abuse trial attorneys from around the country. The other group are newer entrants, more along the mass tort side. And so they just have a very different view on how this should come out. And the law doesn't necessarily choose between those plans and what they want. But none of it looks to how do we reduce the re-traumatization of the victims through this process and in the outcome. This is, once again, we focus on the adults and their institutions, and we make sure they're protected. And kids, in a lot of ways, and the victims are collateral damage.
What would you believe would be a fair settlement to go to these victims?
Well, it would have seemed to me that they needed to put together the council holdings, the Boy Scouts holdings, and the insurance holdings to then have a fair negotiation. Settlements in this arena, on average, so the Los Angeles Archdiocese, when it settled after the 2003 window, the average was $1.4 million per victim. MSU settled with the Nassar survivors at $1.4 per victim. That has been the standard. Now, we've seen some of these diocesan bankruptcies, the averages might be $350,000. But, I mean, you can see $10,000 is dramatically low. And so that's really the universe we're living in, is that bankruptcy judges aren't trained. Bankruptcy law isn't fit to these sorts of issues. And in defense of the bankruptcy judges, they're applying the law. This is what the law Congress gave them. And they don't have latitude to turn this into 80,000 trials about the truth. But we're talking to members of Congress because this really does have to change.
Had the perpetrators themselves been singled out?
Perpetrators have been singled out. The vast majority are well beyond the statute of limitations for criminal prosecution. So, you know, this is the story of our era. The only thing you can do is a civil lawsuit, because once the criminal charges expire, you can't revive them. So for the vast majority of these victims, they're not going to get justice through the criminal justice system. They can name their perpetrator, but the most they can do is to try to find some healing and hope through a lawsuit that gives them the funds to be able to afford the therapy they need and their family will need for the rest of their lives.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Marcy Hamilton. Here is the rest of my conversation with Marcy Hamilton. She's founder and CEO of Child USA, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Fells Institute of Government, and a resident senior fellow in the university's program for research on religion. Marcy, take us back a bit. When and why did the Boy Scouts of America first face these sexual abuse charges?
So there were some very proactive attorneys in Oregon. Kelly Clark, who's passed away now, but very smart, thoughtful lawyers. And they started these cases. There was a major case out of Kansas. And with respect to those early cases, they got enough discovery in the courts that they learned about what came to be called the perversion files. The Boy Scouts were tracking the names of perpetrators, but that was it. They were keeping a file in Austin, Texas, so you could go through and find out, oh yeah, this guy in Iowa was a bad guy, but they were not preventing the Iowa Scoutmaster from then moving to Illinois and becoming a Scoutmaster in Illinois.
Sounds just like the Roman Catholic Church.
It's identical. It's the same MO, right? So what you do is you learn about it, you worry about your own liability, so you keep track a little bit, but then you don't do anything to protect the next kid. That's what's wrong with the system.
So when you look at this whole process, what is the relationship between the national organization and the local chapters? How does that work in terms of this case?
The national organization, the BSA, is the only entity that filed for bankruptcy. It has a relationship with what are called the local councils, which own the campgrounds and the local chapters. But the only entity being sued that was able to file for this kind of massive national bankruptcy was the Boy Scouts. The only way to get any of the assets from those councils into the bankruptcy was for the Boy Scouts to pressure the councils to get involved. Now the councils are involved. They're contributing some money, but they're contributing it so that they can continue to operate.
So if the Boy Scouts of America had not claimed bankruptcy, then what would have happened?
What would have happened is as we open these windows and opportunities for justice around the country, so right now New York, New Jersey, Arkansas, Louisiana, North Carolina, California, in those states there would have been active lawsuits and there would have been discovery. We would have learned more. It would have been individual cases, and individuals would have learned about how was it possible that their perpetrator was still perpetrating and got them. Instead, what we have is, we have a mass meeting, an amalgamation of claims, and none of that's going to happen.
So what do you think this whole lawsuit is going to do to the Boy Scouts of America?
Well, I think what's going to happen is much like what's happened to the Catholic Church. We're going to have a group that doesn't trust them. They're going to have, some problems with their reputation, but they're going to thrive and move on. That's the goal. And they are determined to make that happen. And at this point, this bankruptcy is not going to stop them in their tracks.
So the criminal investigation underway in Michigan, how does that differ from what's going on here?
So, this criminal investigation is good because it's going to give everybody some information, but it's very similar to the grand jury investigations in Pennsylvania. The district attorney, the attorney general, most studied state in the country, vast majority of claims out of statute. So we know a lot in Pennsylvania, but very few prosecutions resulted. Perhaps Michigan will consider some kind of corporate liability that the institutions would be held accountable, but we haven't seen that in the Catholic bankruptcies either.
Really? The Catholic bankruptcies with individual parishes claiming bankruptcy have what, simply closed down?
Oh, no. No, that they have stayed open. They have paid through their insurance proceeds and perhaps selling property, but they have not been charged with any criminal charges, even if they were criminally liable for endangering children.
And what has the Vatican done in terms of these local parishes?
The Vatican has used a lot of words, but until very recently, they were fighting tooth and nail to make sure that there would be no reporting of child sex abuse coming out of the court. They lobby in every state not to have to report known child sex abuse. But the major fight right now with them is over the confessional privilege. They continue to fight with great effect the possibility that a priest who learns about sex abuse in the confession would ever have to disclose it. So if a child goes into confession right now and mentions child sex abuse, and the only place that priest learned about it there, that priest isn't going to the authorities. And that's a broken system. So the biggest barrier right now is the confessional privilege, which is claimed not only by the Catholic Church, but the Latter-day Saints and the Jehovah's Witnesses. And so we have a major problem with how do you get information out of religious organizations that will tell us the truth about the endangerment of children within them.
Now, the Boy Scouts have promised to put more protections in place to ensure that this does not continue to go on. What do you think of that?
Well, internal self-policing doesn't work. We know that for a fact. That's just the science. They're going to have to figure out a system in which there are external restraints that are not controlled by the Boy Scouts that will be related to the protection of children. And so, we have had many dioceses that have agreed to various types of improvements in child protection policies, and there have been changes, but we did a study of all 32 archdioceses child protection policies across the United States. And what I can tell you is that they are all over the map. They are uneven, and not one of them is actually as strong and protective of children as you would hope it would be.
What about the Girl Scouts? Have you heard anything to give you concern that perhaps the same thing is going on within that organization?
That's a really good question. De minimis reports coming out of the Girl Scouts. You know, every organization that has children involved has this problem. The question is the degree of the problem. And the Girl Scouts have not had the model that the Boy Scouts have had. The Boy Scouts model attracts scoutmasters who know they'll get children alone. The Girl Scouts are selling cookies. They're sitting out front. They're earning their badges. They don't have the same isolation as part of the model to a large degree. And so we just haven't seen the same numbers, and we haven't seen the same reporting.
Help me to understand that model of aloneness with a scoutmaster. What goes on there?
So the problem is that to a large degree, the campouts, which are at the heart and soul of this experience, are in forests. They're in places where a cell phone won't work. They're in places where lots of kids in lots of tents and not many adults. So now if it were required that your parent come with you, this would be a different scenario. But there are many more children than adults, and that gives adults the capacity to prey on them.
When you say adults, what is the minimum age for a scoutmaster?
Scoutmasters have to be, legal age of adult, 18 and above. And we know that abusers over 18 are much harder to bring back from abuse than any that are under 18. I mean, we also have some instances of children abusing children because of their home life or whatever problems they're dealing with. But the vast majority of abuse in the Boy Scouts is adult on child. And it's multiple times and multiple victims.
So finally, Marcy, how do you think this case is going to end up?
So it's going to take a long time to know where we land, because first there will be whatever settlement can be agreed to within the bankruptcy courts, and then there will be active litigation against the insurance industry. The insurance companies are going to fight it. So it's, as often it is for victims, hurry up and wait. Here's your bankruptcy, whatever it is, and now we'll see what the insurance companies do.
So the entire $850 million will be fought against by the insurance companies.
No, actually, that $850 million will be paid. But where the real liability lies is with the insurance coverage for which they collected their premiums. And so now there will be active litigation in the courts to get the insurance companies to pay what they promised to pay as part of their coverage.
And how much would that come to?
As I understand it, billions.
Billions.
Billions. That opens the door to the victims getting a much fairer compensation package. But you've got to go through the litigation first. And, you know, in the diocese, usually insurance will end up paying maybe 50% of what they might have otherwise paid. So there will be massive negotiation, there'll be litigation, and there'll be a lot of fights. And for the survivors, my advice to them is to let your attorney take care of that. Make sure you're getting the therapy you need, and don't expect anything anytime soon from them.
This could go on for years.
Easily would go on for years.
Marcy, before we close, is there anything else you'd like to say?
You know, for the survivors that are looking for hope, and feel like they've been kind of left out of the process, I hope they will visit childusa.org. I hope they'll reach out to us. We really want to hear about them and their experiences. We're studying it. We want to make this better.
Marcy, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate the time.
That was Marcy Hamilton, founder and CEO of Child USA, a research and advocacy organization focused on ending child abuse and neglect. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody and Sandra Baker. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well, stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.